For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hey, Tommy, I've been wondering, is Tesla toast?
Yeah, so today we're going to talk about what the heck is going on at Tesla, some of the responses from the public, and of course, some of the responses from the company. But we're also going to talk about a recent adventure I had going to Moab, Utah, and off-roading a Ford Model T, which was really cool, along with a mini fleet update and some funny things happening with the TFL fleet, because we got some strange stuff going on.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun show. So let's start with the question, is Tesla toast? Now, about a month ago now, I did a video asking the question, is Tesla toxic? Of course, in sports, right, there is this pretty well-known saying, love the game, hate the player. Mm. In other words, you can separate the player from the player's performance. And that applies to people like Lance Armstrong, obviously, who is a great cyclist. So you could love his performance, but hate the fact that he took drugs as a person. Also, sometimes people use that for Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods. And I was thinking to myself, can you do that same kind of thing with Elon Musk and Tesla? And in my head, I came to the conclusion that you really can't. There have been a lot of videos from people asking the question, why do people hate the car I'm driving? It has nothing to do with the CEO of the company. But I kind of feel like you can't make that distinction with Tesla because the two are so intertwined.
Well, there's the argument to be made that Elon didn't start the company, right?
Yeah, he purchased it.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, and it's also worth noting that, of course, he's a very influential player in the direction that company has gone. But there were a lot of really talented engineers and product planners and marketing people and financiers and all these folks involved in the company that aren't Elon, right, that made these cars what they are today. So there is that argument to be made that, look, just because he's the guy at the helm doesn't mean he's directly responsible for some of the great products that they have.
Yeah, but it's more than that. With most car companies, the CEO isn't also the director of marketing, right? And with Tesla, Musk has been using Twitter and now X, basically the guy who's been the head of marketing for the company, whether it's at one of the new car launches where he's the master of ceremonies, or whether it's all the kind of statements that he makes about the company on the quarterly calls. He is Tesla and Tesla is him. And that's why I'm saying you can't separate the two. So a lot of people are asking the question, why do you hate the car when the CEO has, nothing to do with the car? I kind of feel like with Tesla, the two can't be so joined at the hip that you can't separate the two.
Well, he's definitely a very public-facing figure within that company, right? But there's other companies, other automakers too, where we see that happen, not to the same extent, but for example, Jim Farley at Ford is also a very public figure, right?
Yeah, he's got his
podcast. Yeah. He does a lot of interviews, where Mary Barra at GM is quite the opposite. She's almost a little bit reclusive in how she operates that company. She's very rarely in the news. She tries never to stir the pot. And those are two very different management styles, right? And I think in some ways, being a very public figure while running a company can be good because you add like a sense of personalization. You personify that company, right? You make it feel more than just a big, big giant organization that's untouchable. You put a face to that. So that can be a positive, and I think that's what Jim Farley's trying to do with his podcast, right? Where he has a personal touch.
I kind of feel like he's now encroaching on our space. It'd be like if my side gig, my side hustle was running a car company.
Sure. And I understand that. But that is a tactic that some companies use. The downside of that is if things start going badly and if you start making enemies, as Elon has very much done, then that can be a really negative impact on the performance of the company.
Okay, there's just a lot of facts that we could throw out. I'll just throw a couple of them out. For instance, in Germany, there was recently a poll done, and 96% of respondents said they would never buy a Tesla because of what Elon Musk has done with his German salute, and I'm being kind by calling it that. But let's just talk about the two biggest markets for him, which are China and the United States. So let's start with China, right? China has always been kind of the place where car companies have gone over the last 10 years because that is the biggest population in the world. That is where the most potential sales are, blue sky. The issue that Tesla has in China, and I don't want to get involved in politics of it, but basically Tesla has this reputation in China of being your dad's Buick. So all the young people there, which is the majority of the people, don't necessarily look at Tesla as being this cool, hip brand, which I think a lot of people in America do because of companies like BYD and Geely that are pushing the electric car beyond what Tesla has done. It's looked upon kind of as the conservative, the Toyota, dare I say, of electric cars. So if in China you're looking for a car for your parents or your grandparents, or you're looking for like a solid car, first car for your daughter, this is where Tesla comes in. But it certainly doesn't embody kind of the cool spirit that a lot of people think of Tesla here in the U.S. And that's a problem because you want young buyers, not old buyers, because young buyers are going to buy more Teslas, whereas old buyers are not going to buy them anymore.
From what I've heard from industry experts in China, there's also quite a bit of kind of nationalistic pride around the Chinese auto industry, right? And a lot of young people want to buy a Chinese-made car. It's a source of pride. And I think when Tesla really started entering that market a bunch of years back in China, they were, as they are in some cases still in the U.S., so far advanced compared to competition. But some of the new products coming out of China, and as Jim Farley said in a recent podcast, the rate at which they can develop new cars has become so fast. They're not only made in that homeland for a lot of folks, but they're also better than what Tesla can offer. They offer faster charging, more features, better designs, cooler tech. And they're kind of leapfrogging that market. So I think that's one of the big problems in China.
Yeah, I've heard this interesting saying. This is a Chinese saying. So if you want to speed up innovation, right, you throw a catfish in with the rest of the fish. Because if you throw a catfish in a pool of fish, the other fish swim faster so that they don't get eaten by the catfish. And that was a strategy that the Chinese government used when they brought in Tesla. The idea was we're going to bring in this kind of catfish company so that all the local fish, in other words, BYD, Geely, all the other car companies are forced to innovate and are forced to swim faster. And I think in essence, it worked.
Sure.
And so Tesla has a China problem. And that is the car company is kind of stodgy.
But I would argue from
their perspective,
what I've read, it's not just a Tesla problem in China. Mm. Other automakers are also facing that because the other OEMs are also facing the same pushback against them.
And your generation in China wants to drive Chinese cars.
We think. Yes. Yeah. We don't know for sure.
But from what we've read and what we've heard. Yeah. The young Chinese don't want to drive
German cars or Japanese cars.
And this is a problem. And it's specifically a Tesla problem because the Chinese government is pushing electric cars. So a lot of the OEMs, the traditional OEMs, are still selling gasoline-powered cars. And yet China is becoming the world's biggest, fastest-growing, most innovative electric car market. And that is a problem. The other problem that Tesla has is that they just unveiled their latest version of full self-driving, and BYD did theirs, and BYD basically gave it away for free. As you know, in America and the rest of the world, if you want full self-driving, you have to pay either a monthly fee, which is pretty substantial. I want to say it's, what, $300 now, or like $10,000 or $8,000, in one go. Whereas when BYD rolled out their version of full self-driving, which according to Chinese drivers is better than Tesla's, it's free.
So let's talk about the U.S. Obviously, the biggest problem, in my opinion, is that Elon has become a very political figure. So, that automatically is going to impact a big percentage of people interested in buying your very expensive vehicle. And then because this becomes so political with Elon Musk's involvement with the government, we're also seeing this harsh backlash against not only Tesla cars in public, but also the Tesla stores through vandalization, for example, right? That's a really big problem.
Yeah, and let's be transparent here, guys. We're trying to stay out of politics as much as possible. But to be transparent, we have owned every Tesla that has been built, right? So we've owned a Model 3, a Model 3 Performance. We now own a Model S. We owned a Cybertruck. We owned a Model Y, and we owned a Model X. So every Tesla we've owned, and I'm a big fan of Tesla as a car company. I love the fact that, you know, they single-handedly transformed the world of cars from internal combustion engine powered cars to electric cars. And, you know, I don't want to get into the debate about electric or internal combustion, but Tesla has to be credited for dragging the rest of the world, the rest of the automakers, into the electric car era.
Yeah, but I think that they've had this like 10-year head start. And I know that the Tesla fans will argue they are still significantly ahead of the other automakers in terms of
not in China
charging. I'm talking about US
yeah.
in terms of charging integration, perhaps range. But what we've seen, at least from the products that I've driven, especially in the last year or two, that's not been the case. I mean, Lucid Air debuted a while back and really pushed the bounds in range and technology. The Hyundai has really been pushing the bounds, and the Koreans have been pushing the bounds on charging technology, right? And I think GM and Ford have done a really good job of kind of integrating maybe not the best of anything in the world, but creating a really strong cohesive package that does really well. Nissan has the affordability with some of the lease deals going on right now. So it's not a case where like you're kind of dumb if you don't buy a Tesla anymore. We've got so many competitive options in the industry. And I think that these OEMs are bringing a their huge weight and ability to produce in mass volumes and economies of scale. And also this customer base that comes with some, like even a brand like Cadillac. I just drove the new Optiq and the new Escalade IQ, right?
Yeah.
And sure, if you're a Tesla person, you're probably like, who buys a Cadillac? But there is still a huge number of folks in the US that are brand loyal to these old school companies that want to buy the Cadillac version. And now you're not being penalized because both the Optiq and the Escalade IQ are excellent EVs and in some ways even better than Teslas, in some ways worse, but they have that brand cachet.
Look, the problem with Tesla and the reason we're asking this question is pretty straightforward. I'm just going to distill it down to the basics. So this country is very split politically with 50% on the left and 50% on the right. The problem is that the CEO of Tesla has decided to put his weight behind the right side of this country, in other words, the Republicans, by doing that, he has alienated the Democrats who are his customers. And so I don't know if a car company can survive with not being able to sell to half the country. Maybe Tesla has thrived under that. But when you piss off the half that is buying your cars, I'm not sure you can survive. And the head scratcher that I don't understand is, even with the huge devaluation of the stock, I think today it's trading at about $240 a share, Tesla's market cap is still worth more than every single car company in the world combined. And that to me is a real head scratcher. And I understand that Wall Street values Tesla as a technology company because technology is easy, right? All you have to do is copy paste if you're selling software. But to me, Tesla is a car company, and they are actually in the business of selling cars and not technology. And I know that the CEO has convinced a lot of people that his connection with the Trump administration and his ability to turn Tesla into a technology company makes it worth, you know, a lot more than a traditional car company. But we're going to put that to the test because let's see what happens when Tesla stops selling cars, which is what's happening right now.
Well, I don't think that's ever going to be the case in the US. I don't think we're going to see. So even when we were getting those huge, a couple months ago, when we were getting those huge decrease in sales in Europe, the sales in the US were only down about 1%, right? So we're going to have to wait and see what the upcoming sales results are going to be, because then we'll get a better picture. So I don't think it's fair to say they're not selling. I mean, I think where we live in Colorado, right, we are a very Democratic state, and we see the outlash in person at our local stores.
Backlash,
thank you. And we've talked to the dealers that saying they're getting a huge number of trade-ins in Tesla. But that's a very small look at the U.S., right? Especially in Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah, but look at California, which is the fundamentally the problem is Democrats are dumping their Teslas, and Republicans, no matter what the Trump administration is doing at the White House, turning into a car dealership, fundamentally hate electric cars because that's one of their core. I mean, look at our comments, right? The biggest comment we get whenever we do a story about electric cars is, you know, you're going to take my internal combustion engine truck car from my cold dead hands. So this seems to be just a tenet of what it means to be a Republican, that you want to drill, baby, drill, and that you want to, you know, burn gasoline, and that you want to power everything with, you know, dead dinosaurs. I know not dead dinosaurs. And so even if Trump himself decides, which he has, to buy a Tesla, I'm not sure he's going to bring the rest of his followers, the rest of the Republicans with him. So I think fundamentally Tesla has this problem where we're seeing it right now with used Tesla values. We just got a study that was done by IC Cars where used Tesla values have dropped the most of any brand, 15%, like that. You know, these are just fundamental things that don't happen in a used car market. And where the used car market goes, that's where the new car market goes. Because if you can't have residuals, then all of a sudden it's impractical to lease a car because the value of that residual determines your lease cost. And if the value of the residual is too low, which is what's happening with Tesla, your lease costs are going to go skyrocketing. And there's only so much that Tesla can do to support that.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
All right, well, let's see what happens.
Yeah, right? Let's see what happens, yeah.
All right, let's move on to a new subject.
All right, these are the subject. I bought this. I don't know how long this is. I think it's like 10 minutes.
That's what I've been looking at my watch. It's 15 minutes, basically.
So every subject gets the...
Yeah, we get the new timer. You see that American Furniture Warehouse. The annoying thing is I'm learning it's not exactly 15 minutes. Well, if you're listening, we have this, like... who invented these, Cole? The sand timers. This was probably like the Romans or someone, or maybe even older. But this reminds me mostly when you're like watching someone in a prison cell where the water is rising, and then like the timer is when the floodgates open. The hourglass remains alone. 8th century by monk named Luitprand.
There you go, hourglass.
There we go. So quite a bit older than I expected.
All right, anyway. So you just took, this is really cool, a Model T to Moab. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Case and I loaded up our 1927 Ford Model T.
Yep.
And we brought it to Utah, yep. the mecca of off-roading.
Where the electricity probably went haywire.
Yes, we had like a 15-hour power outage.
In all of Moab.
Immediately when we got there. Which was unfortunate for charging camera gears and uploading footage and all this stuff. And 10,000 people in Utah, by the way, were out of power, apparently.
Yeah.
So it was a really big deal. But so we brought this
Model T. Luckily, the Model T's not electric.
We brought this Model T to Moab, Utah because...
But it is gas. I know. Let me just finish.
You keep interrupting me.
I know. But it's not electric, which you'd think would be good. But here's the thing that most people don't realize. If you need gasoline, you need an electric pump to pump it out of the...
No, but I think that
all the gas stations were down.
No, I think if I remember right, the one near the city market had a gas generator.
Okay.
So we could have got gas. So that was not a problem.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. So there was a power outage, and we wanted to see what the Model T does off-road.
Yeah.
Because the people that are passionate about Model Ts claim that they have a lot of off-road capability because they were designed in an era pre-paved roads, right? They were designed for ruts and ridges and holes and that kind of thing.
Big wheels, great approach angle.
Yeah. So we took it off-road. Now, the first problem with driving a Model T to Moab is it's very slow. So that wouldn't make sense to drive it to Utah.
So you towed it.
The car really doesn't tow well.
No.
No.
You need like an enclosed trailer.
You really need an enclosed trailer.
You broke the windshield, didn't you?
Well, the windshield broke.
Wait, you broke the windshield.
No, I...
The windshield broke.
The windshield broke. Yeah. I'm not going to claim full responsibility.
Wait. I'm not saying you broke it, but you kind of did.
So the windshield on a Model T is a perfect flat pane of glass.
And you turned it into the wind like a horizontally, so
it's actually two panes of glass.
Because we've done this before. We've broken one windshield before in a Model T.
Yes. It's really two panes of glass.
Yeah.
And then you can fold them open for extra airflow. I folded them open so that we wouldn't get rock chips. The problem is, and I didn't have this issue on the way back because I learned, so that is my fault. You have to make sure that the little wing nuts that hold it horizontal are always tight. Because as you drive, they loosen up and then the windshield can flop down.
And that's what happened.
And it basically hit a big gust of wind and it flopped down on the steering wheel and then cracked the upper windshield, which is a bummer. The cars just don't travel well. They really don't. For example, I think the top is starting to tear now along the edges.
Well, they're not meant to go 75.
75 miles an hour. I also think we left with the side mirror and we arrived with no side mirror.
So you lost the side mirror.
So stuff just starts falling off the car.
Okay, all right.
So it really...
I don't think that was an original side mirror.
No, it was not. No. But the point is like these cars, you really got to put them in enclosed trailers. You're going to...
Hey, if you want to sponsor us and you build enclosed trailers
and you want like our Model T videos, yeah.
If you want a sponsorship.
And we weren't like going 90. We were kind of just doing 75.
Yeah, the speed
and
limit,
still,
yeah. So what was it like driving a Model T off-road?
Well, it's very interesting. It was a really cool experience. We did this pass called Hurrah Pass, which is just outside of Canyonlands National Park. And it's this incredible, amazing vista that you're cruising through. It was absolutely gorgeous. And it starts out at kind of a dirt road, and then it transitions into kind of a light to moderate trail. And you got some ledges and you got some holes.
I'm going to interrupt you just for a second. Cole, we've taken the Model T off-road before. So if you found that video... Not hardcore off-road, but we have taken it off-road once before.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of show what it's like.
No, it's the... There it is.
Yeah, that one. Yeah.
Yeah, so this was a lot harder than the first time
we took
it
off. This was a dirt road, yeah.
So this actually has some pretty good-sized rocks and some ledges. And yeah, it was really interesting. But first of all, the car is amazing. The notion that these are good off-road is true. To some extent. And what I mean by true is the platform and the frame and the suspension are designed for these roads. And you really feel that. And that they have an insane amount of suspension travel and a shocking amount of ground clearance. I mean, we're talking over a foot of ground clearance to that front and rear axle, which is the lowest hanging part. And then the rest is, in some cases, 18 to 20 inches high off the ground. So huge ground clearance.
That suspension working.
Yeah, the suspension is a transverse mounted leaf front and rear.
Yeah.
Incredibly soft, which gives the suspension a lot of ability to work underneath the car, but no shock absorber. So what you end up doing is you hit a bump and then the whole car kind of bounces. So it's very cartoony in how it goes down the trail, but it does do it incredibly well. And then the tires on our 1927 are a little bit more modern than this one on this 1915. It's a little bit wider. And they did a really good job of keeping in contact with the ground and keeping the car moving. So, for example, we had to go through a bit of a mud hole and kept some momentum. And the tires cut right through the mud into the firmer bottom and just kept us chugging.
Now, you said that you were worried about how hard the pass was and how difficult, the terrain was. Much more difficult than this video we're watching. And you kind of were going way too fast up Hurrah Pass.
So the problem with Model Ts off-road and the thing that people don't talk about, the reason that this car wouldn't work as like a quote-unquote rock machine is the way that the transmission is set up in the gearing. So Model Ts came out of the factory with a two-speed transmission.
Yes.
And it's not a sliding gear transmission like in a more modern car.
There's belts.
It's a planetary gear set.
Okay.
So you've got these drums in the transmission, and they essentially look like drum brake bands that clamp onto the drums that allow you to select the gears. So when you push down on the left pedal, it clamps a band onto this low gear drum and then forces you into low. And the same thing with reverse and same thing with the brake. The problem is it's not quite low enough and the car doesn't really have enough power to crawl slowly. So
enough torque.
Yeah, you can hold a Model T at like 4 or 5 miles an hour pretty happily and that engine will have enough torque to get you anywhere. But if you want to go between like 0 and 2, you end up really grinding the bands down to bare metal, which is very bad news. So my solution to that was to go foot hard on low gear, clamp that band down so it wouldn't slip, and then rev the beans off the engine, which means you're going pretty fast. And it did great. Like, it was, we were having a great time and we were just bounding over these rocks and we were like bouncing off the seat, and it was a hilarious situation, and the car was doing great. But then when Case drove back, he was much more careful and used a lot less throttle. And we learned that, like, you really don't see any benefit in power in the upper RPMs. You can just kind of lug it around at 800 RPM and it'll have the same amount of torque. So Case was a better driver on this trip. But it was such a cool experience, and everybody was incredibly stoked to see this thing out on the trail.
Now, ours is, 27, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it has steel wheels as opposed to wooden wheels.
Yep.
So I don't think I'd want to take a Rod Pass with wooden wheels.
You know, you say that, but this 1915 we had, if it didn't overheat as viciously as it did.
Did the 27 overheat?
No.
So we've taken it now up to top of Pikes Peak, mm-hmm. where it did overheat.
Twice.
Yeah, but Hurrah Pass, no overheating.
Yeah, but if the 1915 didn't overheat as badly as it did, yeah. I think in some ways that would have been even better. Because the 27 has more wheel travel. Not that we ran out, but it's got more wheel travel.
Yeah.
And it has an aftermarket accessory called the Ruxtel,
yeah.
which is a two-speed differential in the back.
So that rearview mirror that we just saw, that's the one that fell off.
That one there.
On the left, yeah.
Yeah. Was there one on the right, too? Did we lose both of them?
There's never one on the right.
Okay, I think there's only one on the left. Yeah, yeah, so that one is no longer there.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, you can see it's overheating there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the 1915 would have been better in some ways because there's an extra low gear, which would have really helped with the crawling, because we could have used a little bit more gearing. But wow, what a cool experience. And the cars are so unbelievably tough. I mean, they are, you know, you look at them and you think, oh, these cars look like museum pieces, or you don't want to touch them, you don't want to engage with them, but they are just built like tanks. They're really over-engineered, really under-engineered, but really overbuilt, and they just last through anything.
And the great thing about Model Ts, for all of you non-Model T types out there, which is everybody, I take it, yeah, there it goes, overheating, is they're not expensive, right? I think we bought this one for, what, $8,000?
Yeah, this was $8,000. Yeah, our other one was like $12,000.
But the older the car, the more expensive it is.
Yeah, and I do like... I think the older ones are a little cooler.
Yeah.
Just because you've got the wooden wheels and you've got the brass radiators are really cool, and they just look a little bit more vintage. This car looks a little bit more like a Model A, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But it doesn't quite have that like old-timey look.
Yeah, it doesn't have the brass. It's not a brass era car.
Right. But this car is in some ways a better car because it has real brakes in the back, right? It's got actual drum brakes versus just a parking brake.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more sorted. I actually, and the other thing too about our 15 is that they all use pretty much the same engine, super low compression, like 3-to-1 compression. But the early cars were a lot lighter. So this car's got these kind of big fenders, make it look more contemporary for the time, but that adds a lot of weight.
So we can kind of switch over to the fleet update now, even though we didn't quite use the whole timer. So we'll finish this with a fleet update. So if people are wondering, last year we actually bought three ASIC Fords, right?
Mm-hmm.
We bought 1915, which kind of got us started on the journey.
Yep.
And then we bought a Model A Ford pickup.
Yes.
Which is a 31, I believe.
Yes.
And then we bought this one, which is a Model T pickup.
1927.
Yeah. And then we sold the other two to Brighton Ford, where they're on display at the dealership,
mm-hmm.
as kind of a memory of the past of Ford's heritage. And it's kind of cool. And the reason we sold them is because we don't run car collections. We use all of our cars to produce videos. And if they're just sitting there and not producing any content with them, then we're running a museum and we don't like to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, though, if you have a small budget for a classic car.
A Model T is a great way to go.
Well, there's some asterisks. If you don't live in a city, like these cars are really bad in a city where there's a lot of stoplights and congestion. But if you live even in like suburbia, there is no more fun you can have in a car than a Model T. They're very slow, but nobody cares. Like, you're always worried. I'm always, when you first buy these cars, you're worried about keeping up traffic, but people just don't give a darn because it's such a cool thing to see on the road. They're more fun to drive than any modern car because the controls are all backwards. They're easy to work on than any car ever made. I mean, they're designed to be fixed by farmers and fields. Even I've been able to fix them. Like we've done fuel tanks and we've put a head on one and done some rear end work and some brake work, and I put tires on one, and they're just like really easy and fun to work on. And people love them. They're just great. And they don't appreciate, they don't depreciate. So you can buy one for $8,000. You can drive it for a year. You can sell it for $8,000. It costs 38 cents to insure. Just an amazing experience.
And there's like a community of really old dudes who'll be happy to talk your ear off when something goes wrong and tell you exactly how to fix it.
The Model T community is incredibly supportive.
Yes.
Yeah, they really want people to remember and keep this hobby alive. And, you know, there's a lot of different numbers out there, but some estimate that there's upwards of 1 million Model Ts still left.
They built like, what, 20 million or something?
They built, I think it was 15 million.
Anyway,
it's a huge number.
Yeah, they built a lot.
So they built all these cars, and there's still a ton of them out there, and you can buy any part that you'd ever need. Well, they get kind of expensive parts, but you can get anything you ever need for one. So I strongly recommend the Model T hobby. I actually like it more than the A. I think the Ts are a little bit...
Yeah, so the A was kind of... We had bought this beautiful Model A pickup truck, and it was just spectacular. And the cool thing about the Model A is now you're talking about a traditional transmission with a traditional clutch and a traditional brake pedal location.
Sure.
So if you know how to drive a manual, you'd be able to drive a Model A. But there's just something that you lose in that translation where it's not as cool as a Model T.
Well, I think
That's part of your Model A that we sold. Yeah.
Part of it is, so we had this really nice truck.
Yeah.
The truck was really cramped. So if you get a two-door like this one, it's a little bit more spacious. And then the open top things are always the most fun. So I'd probably, if I were to get a Model A again, which I'd like to because they're interesting cars, the convertible would be the way to go. Part of the reason I like the T's is a lot of them are just open to the elements.
Yeah.
And they're also cheaper than Model A's.
So they're less usable. This Model A was, I think, 21 or 22,000. So there's a substantial price increase when you go to a Model A.
Yeah, this was a really nice one. I think it was more, wasn't it? Like 25 or 30?
It may have been. Yeah, but it was like a complete restoration.
Yeah, this was a lot nicer than the T's. But the T's, I just think are
it was too nice for us.
More interesting. Yeah, the wooden wheels are problematic from an upkeep standpoint, but they do look very cool on the older Model T. So yeah, so we sold the Model A and the really old T to Brighton Ford, and now we have the 27, which I still love the car. I think it's a really cool little car, and I'm excited. There's a whole bunch of stuff I have to do now. Like, so when we bought this car, it had been sitting for a long time, as most have, and it was nicely detailed, and the engine was oil-free, and it didn't leak, right? And then we took it up Pikes Peak, and then driving it around town, and then driving it off-road, and now the thing leaks like a...
sieve.
Yeah, because they didn't really use seals in the engines back in the day, and everything kind of loosened up. And it needs a new radiator fan, and it needs a new fan belt and all this stuff.
All right. I think we've exhausted our timer here for the Model T. So let's flip it over again, and let's talk about the rest of our fleet. And why don't you tell them about the interesting thing that happened when – so the Brighton Ford, where we sold the Model T, they took a 2007 Aston Martin in Entree, the Vantage.
Mm-hmm.
And the dealer has become a good friend of ours, and he was about to sell it to another dealer because, you know, it's a weird thing for a Ford dealership to sell. And so he sold it to us for $33,000.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
And I got to say, it's one of the sexiest, one of the most beautiful cars I've ever seen, the Vantage. And the issue, there it is, the issue with the Vantage was that this is your dream car, but there's a problem.
Well, so we insure a lot of our classic cars with Hagerty.
Yeah.
And Hagerty's a really good insurance company that we've worked with in the past, right? Really affordable, and they work with enthusiast cars. And when you went to insure this, they specifically told you that I am not allowed to drive this car through the company policy because it's listed as a supercar.
Which is weird because it's 390 horsepower.
And 380. It's not even 390.
Which today isn't super.
And it's based on like the category it falls in, right?
Yeah.
It's not based on horsepower. And then based on my age specifically, right, at 27, I'm in a high risk category, so I can never drive this car. Well, I've been saving my pennies and I sold a car and I'm trying to buy this car from the company.
You sold your Mini.
Yeah, my classic Mini I sold. And I'd love to buy this car, but I can't buy this car if I can't insure it. So I called up Hagerty and wanted to see what was going on, see if I could insure it under my personal Hagerty policy where I have like my old Mercedes. And the lady was like, oh, I can't answer this. Let me transfer you to the specialty department. So they transferred me to the specialty department and I explained the situation. And she was like, well, it is listed as a supercar. She's like, have you ever owned or driven any fast cars? I'm like,
Yeah, a few.
A couple. And then she's like, it doesn't seem like this has a lot of power. I'm like, no, it doesn't. It's 0 to 60 in 5 seconds. It's 380 horsepower. It's, by modern standards, it's not a ton. So she was like, I don't see why we couldn't insure this for you. I'll write a note on your record. It'll be $700 a year. So basically they went from, he can never drive this car, to like, yeah, welcome to the Haggerty family for $700 a year. So that was a pretty funny situation. But like there's certain cars I've read that are really hard to insure. Like, as I understand it, Haggerty will insure McLarens, right?
Yeah.
But they won't insure one unless you've already owned it for 3 years under a different insurance company. Because the crash tables show that people are that likely to crash a McLaren in the first 3 years that they can't justify insuring it, which is pretty nuts.
You know, there are some, at least one thing that's good about getting old, and that is you can insure cars that somebody in their 20s would struggle insuring.
Well, the funny thing is,
the irony is that Tommy is much more conservative in the way he drives than I do.
Well, yeah, and I've never ever had a speeding ticket, or I've never had a traffic infraction at all. Like, I've never been cited for anything. In the 12 years I've been driving, I've never gotten a ticket.
You're an 80-year-old in a 27-year-old's body.
Exactly, that's right. And look, like State Farm, they were fine with me driving around in our 480-horsepower Mustang, yeah. Right? Or even the Hellcat at 18, that was fine.
Yeah.
But this 380-horsepower Aston, and I think part of it is it's the brand, right? And it's also, these cars are incredibly expensive and difficult to fix.
Yeah.
So they're full aluminum, and they're just very hard to get right if there's even a small accident. So that can total them. But that was a funny experience. Yeah, and then as you mentioned, I sold my Classic Mini.
Yeah, congratulations.
Mm-hmm. And we sold.
Are you sad?
A little.
What year was it?
It was a 93.
Yeah,
it was
and then you fixed it up a little bit. We kind of went through it and made it much more reliable. You redid the interior. It was just a really nice little car.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you sold it to a mini enthusiast. You sold it to a painter who's going to be driving it around Colorado and painting landscapes. How cool is that of a job, right? To be a painter and then have a Classic Mini to drive around Colorado. There it is.
Yeah. The pretty cool guy, actually. 100%. He got a great car at a pretty good deal. And I put a ton of money into it. And we did engine work and suspension work and interior and wheels and tires and the fog lights and the stripes and the radio. And, I mean, the car was really well sorted. So, yeah, he's getting a really good little car. And I'm definitely going to miss it because that was kind of my dream car as a kid. And then I, you know, worked really hard and put all this money into it 5 years ago and for the past 5 years. But I kind of felt like I had all the experiences I wanted to have in that car. I got to road trip it, drive it in the city and take friends in it, and Blaze was in it and all these things. And like, I had all the adventures I wanted to have in it. So now it's time to move on to the new adventures.
Well, let's keep going through the fleet. So as you guys know, we recently, a month ago, actually bought a new Toyota 4Runner. And I hate when people say, like, go watch the video. So we don't do that on this podcast. We figure if you want to hear it, you're here. So let's tell you about it now. But Tommy did a video that'll be out this weekend as well, kind of going around and talking about what it's like to own a 4Runner for a month, which is about as long as anybody's owned one because we were one of the first to get it.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of podcasts would say, go watch the video. We're not going to do that. We're going to tell you exactly what we think of the car after a month. So Tommy, after owning the 4Runner for a month, what do you think of it? The new one, the sixth gen.
So I had five good things and I had five bad things.
All right, start with the good.
From a drivability standpoint, yeah. The engine is awesome. It's the first 4Runner that doesn't feel like it's struggling at our elevation.
And it's a four-cylinder turbo, so a lot of people are put off by that, especially in the Tacoma, which has the same powertrain.
Yes, but I would counter that by saying, even though it's a, quote, new engine, it's been out for a bunch of years in the NX and in the Highlander, and it's proven itself to be really good. And the Lexus RX as well, people have been really stoked with the longevity so far. Granted, it's only a few years it's been out, but it looks like it's holding up pretty well. So that's good. Capability, as this video shows, perfect video, Cole. Incredible. It is the most off-road worthy 4Runner I've ever experienced. It has enough clearance. It has enough traction. It has incredible multi-terrain select and crawl control, the best it's ever been. The throttle programming has been incredible. And then on top of that, this was my other like, the transmission is just a gem. This eight-speed, right?
Yep, eight-speed. Yep.
Sorry, I'm losing it here. But it like off-road, it holds gears long so that it's not constantly upshifting in low range. It's smooth on the road. It's always in the right gear when you go to pass. It's just such a well-programmed unit. So that's definitely one of my favorite things about it. So we talked about engine, transmission,
seats,
capability. Yeah, seats are pretty good. That was the other one, was interior comfort and features. So if you want luxury features, this thing has pretty much everything you want. It's got ventilated seats, sunroof, heated seats, heated steering wheel, automatic climate control, Apple CarPlay, 15-inch screen. Like, there's not a lot.
But only for, I'll cut to the chase, we paid $57,000, which was MSRP for it.
$58,000.
Yeah, and we only have one zone climate, which is really weird.
That is weird. But apart from that, like, the amount of just tech bobbins this thing has is pretty much on par with the luxury vehicle. And then I would say livability. It's just a really easy car to live with. It's got plenty of room. It's got good seats, as you mentioned. It's a very usable, livable car.
Yeah, they added 3 inches to the wheelbase, so it's 3 inches longer. And they said, I think two of those inches went to the back seat. So if you've got a fifth generation 4Runner, this one will be bigger and more comfortable for people in the back.
So those were my likes. My dislikes, I talked about this in the video, fuel economy.
This was a shocker to me.
As much as I love this engine, which I think it is a really good engine, the efficiency has been a little bit disappointing. So we ran a 75-mile-an-hour highway test. At the same time, Andre and you ran a highway test.
With the Tundra, old and new.
Yes, and the fuel efficiency was identical pretty much between
the old and new Tundra.
The 4Runner and the old and new Tundra, right?
Which was what?
22-23
yeah.
On the highway. Now, granted, that was at 75 miles an hour. I did this video here comparing no chin, that air dam compared with the air jam. There you go, 23.4 mpg. So that's a huge improvement over the old one,
We don't have the hybrid. Ours is not the hybrid.
We'll talk about that in a sec. The old one might do 18 mpg at 75. So 23 is really good. But if it's on par with the Tundra, it feels like it should be a little better. Now, the hybrid is one of those things where I would forego, right? You lose a little storage space. It's more
expensive. 4 inches.
Heavier.
Yeah.
You get all this torque. But from my experience with the Land Cruiser Hybrid, it doesn't feel any quicker.
Yeah, you get 2 mpg better.
Yeah, it's just a really slight increase. So I would skip the hybrid and get the normal one, but I just wish the economy was a little better on the normal one.
Now, I was reading a story recently, I think it was on Jalopnik, and they said that the 4Runner is one of the cars that's being marked up over MSRP, which is really hard to already believe because the thing is already... So if you get the base SR5, it's not much more expensive than the fifth generation, but then when you start going up trim levels, the delta between the old one and the new one just increases. And I think ours was $8,000 more than the old TRD Pro Premium.
No, TRD Off-Road.
TRD Off-Road Premium.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the price was my number one dislike.
Yeah.
And I know that they hold their value, which is a big deal. And if people are charging over MSRP and people are buying it, then maybe the pricing is on the market. But it just feels a little expensive for what you get. That was one of my dislikes. Other dislike.
But can I jump in here for a sec?
Yeah.
You know why that is, right?
Because of the resale values.
Yeah, the residuals are astronomical. So people will buy a 4Runner and they will spend or borrow a lot of money because they know that 3 years from now, traditionally, that 4Runner will be worth what they paid for it, give or take.
Yeah, traditionally, but I'm not convinced that it's going to transfer over to this gen because the price is so high.
Yeah, we'll find out. It's too early.
So that was my number one dislike. We talked about fuel economy. Ride quality is a little choppy.
It is a little choppy.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because we've got the TRD Off-Road, which should have better ride quality. In our experience, off-roaders actually usually have better on-road.
Well, I would like to try the Pro and the Trail Hunter and the SR5 and the Limited and see how those compare. But it's it does okay over big undulations, but on the high frequency stuff, the little bumps, it's pretty jittery. So that it's not enough to say don't buy it, but it's a little annoying. I also don't think the interior is very good. So we talked about the luxury features, the number of features. If you look at what it has,
they definitely downgraded the materials.
But yeah, the quality of the fit and finish and what they've actually used, it's all pretty much black plastics.
Hard black plastic.
Yeah, and the door handle is this crappy molded thing where you can feel the molding around it, this black plastic thing. Like, at this price point, it needs to be better. And the seats are great, right? The steering wheel is good. But when you start interacting with more of the interior, things start to fall apart a little bit.
And that the giant iPad that is a screen, it just feels like it was stuck on. It doesn't feel integrated into the dashboard whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
It actually blocks some of your view out the front because it's so tall.
Yes. Yeah. That I think. And they do a smaller version. So this is the 15-inch screen.
Yeah.
They have a smaller version in the standard TRD Off-Road. So those are my primary dislikes. Oh, and then rear seat space. It's 6 feet tall. The driving position, get in the back seat. You're pretty tight on legroom in the back.
You should try the old one. We did that comparison. It's much worse.
Is it much worse? Yeah. So I think that they should have prioritized a little bit more in the legroom department for rear seat passengers. But I will say, all of those aside, as a whole, the vehicle is a vast improvement over the fifth gen of 4Runner. That, like, for example, our producer Grant has one, and just driving them back to back, it is night and day, the livability differences. And even though I complain about the fuel economy, it is a lot better in the new one. And the tech is really good. And they really did a lot of stuff right on this car. I wish it was a little cheaper is the biggest complaint. But apart from that, it's the fastest, it's the best, it's the most capable 4Runner they've ever done.
Yeah, so let's talk about our other new acquisition, which is the Corvette, actually new to us. We bought a C8 Corvette, probably overpaid a little bit. We paid $72,000 for a 3LT with the Z51 package with 6,000 miles. I just fallen in love with that car. I have one complaint, and that is it's like driving or it's like being in a suit that's one size too small. If you're a big guy like me.
Corvette?
The Corvette is a little tight.
You think?
Yeah, for me especially. Yeah, it's just a little tight. But every Sunday morning, I call it the Church of Corvette because I've been driving in the mountains and just getting into the flow of the car, and I'm just really loving. Basically, I was listening to the Smoking Tire podcast, and they said it's like a Miata with a big engine, and I think they're right about that. It's just so.
Well, the old one was. This one's not at all like a Miata.
I think it's like a Miata.
It's mid-engine. How can it be like a Miata? Just
in the way that it steers, in the way that it handles, in the way that it's connected to your brain. I think it's like a Miata with a much bigger engine. And that's a compliment. I'm not trying to be, I'm just trying to say the car gets much smaller the quicker you go around you. I really love and I'm driving it at, maybe 50% of its capability. And the faster you go, the more fun it gets. And you don't necessarily have to go triple the speed limit to actually start enjoying it. The one complaint that I have with it, it's like that 911 we had, the brakes squeak. I seem to be able to only buy cars with squeaky brakes.
Yeah, the Aston has really squeaky brakes too.
Yeah, and when you go and ask the service guys I actually asked a Porsche engineer, why do these brakes squeak? And he said two things: performance brakes squeak. So I don't know, three cars now, they all squeak. But the other problem is, basically, the rear brakes squeak, and then the problem with the brake squeak is that you've got this amplifying wheel well, right? So even a little bit of squeak gets amplified because it's like a giant speaker in that wheel well, and so any little squeak makes a lot of sound. But I'm really enjoying this car. It's got 495 horsepower. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like it. It feels like it's a little bit down on power because it's naturally aspirated. I'm sure if we had it at sea level, but to me, anything above 500, 600 horsepower is a waste. So it's, I don't lust for like the Z06 or any of the ZR1 or maybe the Zora that's coming up. I know people or the E-Ray. I think I like the fact that it's rear-wheel drive. I like the fact that, the horsepower isn't way over the top. It just makes for a car that doesn't scare you but is very enjoyable on a Sunday morning in the mountains.
So the...
Uh-oh, our timer died.
Yeah, and they're becoming, like I said, I think we overpaid for ours because I saw one just recently sell for like $58,000.
If you want to get a bargain on a C8 Corvette, go to Cars and Bids because they're just selling Corvettes. People are buying, when they say well bought, there's a lot of well bought Corvettes on Cars and Bids.
Well, the weird thing is like I did this video and then everyone's like, you can't get Corvettes for this price. And a lot of people are right in that the best deals on them are at Cars and Bids. So maybe if you want to buy one there. You want to sell one, maybe sell them not there. But like, look, realistically, mid-60s will get you a pretty decent C8 now.
Yeah.
What I might consider doing is if I wanted one in the mid-60s or low 70s, you can order a new one for 69 and some change, right?
1LT.
Yeah, base model.
I think they're more now. They used to be 69.
No,
they
used to be 59. I just looked this up for this video. What? 2025 starting price is 69.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, and there's a 2026, I suppose, there's a refresh coming too, so keep that in mind.
Yeah, so get one now if you want one. Yeah. But I'd be tempted to just order the... Do you like the 3LT?
I do. I'm getting to the age where I like all of the creature comforts. So it's got the...
Let's see what the base is.
2GA or... That's the name of the seat. The
GT2, I think.
GT2, the
seat. $69,995.
Yeah, so I like that. I like the little touches like the red, and I think this is an option, but the red seat belts. I love the heated steering wheel, the heated and cool seats. It's because I've been driving it here in the winter, and if there's no snow on the ground, it's fine. And I love the fact that it feels premium. So I do love the 3LT.
There were about 28 of them at Cars and Coffee.
When I know. There. Yeah. And they're for sale. Like, I mean, I think people, 2020 was the first year. So by 2025, everybody who's wanted one has gotten one.
Yeah.
And now they're moving on and they're looking forward to something else, either the Z06, if you're going to stay in the Corvette family, or something else. And so there's a lot of C8s for sale now, which has also made the C7s more affordable.
Yes. And C6s too, coming down in value pretty consistently.
And let's tell them what we're going to go look at today. We're you know, last year, Case bought a, was it last year or 2 years ago?
2 years ago, yeah.
He bought a C4. Mm-hmm. And then last year we bought a C5 and a C6. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to be, as a company, looking for a C3.
Yeah, but I don't love the one that we're looking at.
We're going to go look at one this afternoon. It's only got 18,000 miles on it, but it is an automatic. And it is a 77, and that means it's emissions choked.
Yes.
There's just a huge difference in price in the C3s. So any pre-70s carry a premium. Any manuals carry a premium. Any 427s carry a premium. And the later you get past like 76, especially if you get into the Crossfire ones, nobody wants them. And they, I think 1977 was the year that they sold the most Corvettes ever. I want to say it's like 30,000 units.
Which is funny because it was like one of the worst eras of Corvettes.
Yes, and yet they sold the most ever. Late 70s. I know.
I think it's still an incredibly beautiful design that has aged very well.
I love the Coke bottle shape.
But they're very hard to find in that have not been like
they weren't well
neglected
built.
And then, or ones that are low miles, people want crazy money for. So like this person wants 20 grand for an automatic C3.
It's probably a $15,000 car.
It's probably like a $13,000 car.
Yeah, because the problem is they just built so many of them.
And they're just not very good cars.
No, they're not. The early ones were good. The later ones were not good.
Yeah, so I'm not really sure about this one, but we can go look at it.
The other problem with the C3s is, especially the 70s ones, later 70s ones, the interiors didn't hold up. The paint didn't hold up. A lot of them have like this cracking in that little pointy nose. Cause I think that was a common problem where those noses got hit. It just seems like there was a lot of issues with them. And of course they weren't the one we're looking at, 3-speed automatic. That thing is going to be slower than our tractor, Tommy.
Yes, that's right. All right. Well, enough with old Corvettes. I think that's good. Yeah. I want to talk about two cars that we had here the other day. So we had two Nissans recently. We have the new Nissan Sentra and the new Nissan Rogue, right?
Yes.
And Nissan's been in kind of a tough position lately. Leadership change and you know, there's companies not doing super hot. So we had the Nissan Sentra, and I thought it was actually a really good little car.
I think it's a great economy car.
We had a really nice loaded one that had these quilted leather seats. It had the screen was super easy to use, really colorful. It was quiet. It was efficient. Jen just did a review on TFL Now. Cole, for that car. And I genuinely like driving it. I thought it was such a quiet, comfortable little car, and it was relatively good value as well. So I was like, all right, maybe Nissan is on the right track.
The problem with Nissan is the company has no fizz right now.
Well, so
they're building good cars, but they're just boring good cars.
So then I drove the Rogue.
Yeah.
They sent us the Rogue the week later. And it's on the left there, Cole, the red one. And the Rogue was $48,000. Which was $4,000 or $5,000 more than the Tucson Hybrid we had on the same week. And the Rogue was not a hybrid. It didn't deliver more space than the Tucson. It didn't deliver a better warranty. It didn't do anything better than the Hyundai. And I was just like, well, maybe this is the problem. So it's like the Nissan product line, you've got some really good cars, and then you've got stuff that just isn't competitive.
Well, here's what I would say. I think that in this last decade, there has been a complete absence of an understanding that car companies need to create excitement, and I'm going to call it fizz in the brand, by producing cars that people lust after, specifically car enthusiasts, cars that either do something different or are somehow styled in a really cool way. And that has just completely disappeared from a lot of the automotive landscape. And the first guy who saw that, I think, and you have to give him credit, was Akio Toyoda, where he went back and he said, enough of these boring cars that we're building. We're going to put some lead back in the pencil. And, you know, all of a sudden you start to see cars like the Supra, the GR Corolla, and, you know, and it works its way down the line. Even if you look at the Camry, the TRD, right, that's a pretty good looking car. And I think when you have a brand like Nissan and Volkswagen's another one that doesn't have anything where you're like, holy cow, I really lust after that. Right, so Nissan had the GTR for a while, but jeepers creepers, man, is that thing long in the tooth. And the Nismo Z just doesn't cut it. But you need to create excitement and fizz around the brand to be able, especially in this day, because I think people are looking for something that suits their lifestyle more than just basic transportation.
Yeah, but like Nissan, you discount the Z, but the Z is a pretty cool car. Man. I think it's a darn cool car. It's too expensive, but it's a pretty interesting car.
If we were to go to the Nissan dealership here in Boulder, would they have one in the showroom?
Yes.
They would not.
I think they do.
They don't. I promise you they don't.
Should we see? Let's see.
See. They won't have a Z in the showroom, nor will they have a GTR.
Well, the GTR has been discontinued.
It's that kind of excitement that you need to create around the brand. And the companies that have those cars tend to do much better, especially in today's car environment, than the companies don't. I think that's one of the, you know, there's been a lot of talk about Volkswagen. That's one of the issues that Volkswagen has. Until the ID. Buzz came along, There was nothing in the Volkswagen dealership that you'd want to, let's face it, the GTI and the Golf R.
They don't have a Z, you're right.
Of course they don't. Are kind of stayed and, you know, have been around maybe too long, or also the concept of them. You just need something to inject some, like, life into the brand. And I think the companies that have that are the companies that are succeeding.
Well, the most valuable company is only building kind of electric blobs.
Tesla?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a lot of lust for a Plaid, a Tesla Model S Plaid.
There was a lot of lust for a Plaid. But I'm saying, like, I think that the cars are really good. The Tesla products are really good. And they all have some level of excitement. But I'm saying, I don't think a lot of Teslas have the car enthusiast level of excitment, where someone who's interested,
they have a tech enthusiasm that's also as valuable to the brand.
Maybe.
But
I just don't know if a brand, to be a sales success, do they really need...
Yeah, I think nowadays you do.
But Toyota doesn't sell a lot of Supras.
Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you sell a lot. It creates kind of the zeitgeist around the company. This company is cool and happening and, you know, something you want to be associated with, as opposed to kind of boring and stale. I think Ford has done that same thing with the Bronco. And the problem is that after the 392, right, Jeep has got nothing right now. So Jeep's kind of in a funk where they don't have anything that creates excitement.
So you think a company needs a halo brand?
I think they do. Yeah, I think you need a halo car or vehicle that people aspire to. So we can go down the line and you can see the companies that are struggling and they don't have that. That's kind of a broad look at it, but I think it's a valid argument.
Yeah, I think there is an argument to be made there. It's tough, though, for me to, like, rationalize that, and especially for the car companies to rationalize that, if the car companies don't sell that many of those products, right?
I mean, Chevy's got the Corvette,
right?
What
does Hyundai have?
Hyundai has the new Ioniq 5N. I think that has created a lot of excitement. It's the first electric cars, and a lot of people will say this, that it's actually made electric cars fun to drive.
Sure.
So they have created something like that. They also have that 74 that I, by the way, maybe you'll get to see that. If they're actually building that, the crazy little hydrogen.
They're not going to show that to me.
Tommy's going to Korea in 2 weeks.
Maybe they will surprise us. But yeah, that would be pretty cool.
Right. So they're also going down that road.
Yeah.
I think Stellantis is really struggling to have anything that, you know, with the Hellcats, they did really well with Dodge. But by putting out the electric Charger, I think they really kind of shot themselves in the foot, and they need, and I think it's coming. I think there's the Hellcat Charger's coming back again, but it's going to take a while to re-engineer that. You know, what let's look at some other companies.
BMW?
BMW has the M series of cars.
But there's an argument to be made that they're struggling, right? And they do have, M3, M5, M2, right?
Yeah.
So they've got enthusiast products. Maybe they're not the right enthusiast products.
But they have them.
Mercedes, same thing, right? They've got the AMG line of vehicles.
I think the car that Mercedes has that is the one... What car do you think Mercedes has that represents that kind of fizz? That still has it and still is... It's actually the car that Mercedes will tell you is bought by the people with the most amount of money.
Probably the S-Class.
You'd think.
What is it?
G.
Oh, a G-Wagon. Yeah, okay.
Right? G, 4x4 squared, right?
Yeah.
So these are halo cars that still work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think you're right. Maybe I think you've changed my mind. Yeah, it is important for these brands to have these exciting products. I mean, I think
that's why Mazda struggles.
They have Miata.
Yeah, they have Miata. We talked about this, right? Miata has been the same car for the last 25 years.
Right.
They haven't done anything interesting or new or fun with it.
But like, keep in mind, like when we say struggling from our perspective, enthusiasts, but for the hundreds of thousands of people out there that just want a simple blob to drive around, right? Like the RAV4 does that.
Yeah, but somehow,
you think someone buying a RAV4 is looking at that RAV4? But
even the RAV4, they have like 15 variants of it, right? They have the Adventure, they have the Prime, right?
Sure,
it's not just a blob. Yeah. There are interesting engineering versions of that car,
right? But they're more marketing than anything. I mean, the Prime is a genuinely cool product, right? But the RAV4 TRD Off-Road, right?
Even
RAV4 Adventure, right? Those are pretty much just, that's kind of a...
Even Honda has the R, right?
In the motorcycle world, it's called BNG.
Yeah.
Bold New Graphics.
Yeah, okay.
That's kind of what RAV4 is, right? They just do bold new graphics on the side of it, and then it's you know...
But even Honda has, you know, the Civic Type R, which they don't sell a lot, but it does inject that kind of fizz into the brand. Well, Tommy, Cole, have we gone an hour? Are we at an hour? Oh, we're 57. So let's talk about...
I think you can close it at 57.
No.
I don't think anyone is on pins and needles here.
There was something I wanted to talk about that was, I thought, very important, and now I've completely forgot. Oh, yeah. Me and Tommy are going to be on the Chelsea Handler podcast. Can you believe that?
Wow. I don't know why that is.
On Monday.
That's pretty wild.
So if you're listening to this on Monday, head on over to Facebook and check out the Chelsea Handler podcast, where Tommy and I are going to be talking about, I don't know, the best car to have sex in. What does Chelsea Handler talk about?
I don't know. We're about to find out.
So I'm really looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. That'll be fun. And then you're off to, like you said, to Korea to check out some of the latest and greatest Hyundais.
Yep, I'm really excited about that.
Can I do a quick rant?
Sure.
All right. Now, I understand that some car names are hard to pronounce, but it really is like nails on chalk to me when people who should know better don't know how to pronounce the car brand or the name.
Okay.
And I'm not going to name names because that's wrong, but I will tell you some car brands that people have a really hard time with.
Okay.
Obviously, everybody knows Porsche. Porsche in German, there's no silent letters. You always pronounce the letters, so it's always Porsche. That's an easy one. Here's one. Any of the Porsche models, Taycan. Not Taycan, Taycan.
Yeah, well, hold on, though. Maybe the problem is the manufacturer chose a terrible name for
the car. I agree. Another one. You say Tuareg like the British. I say Touareg. This is an African tribe. So these are hard names to pronounce. But if you're a broadcast journalist, you should know how the car manufacturer wants their...
That's a good one.
Hyundai.
Yeah.
Like Sunday.
Let's go back to
Hyundai.
Let's go. But it's so confusing, though.
It is.
So Touareg is named after an African tribe called Tuareg.
Yes.
Which is spelled differently.
Yes.
T-U-A.
I know. It's hard to spell. Yeah, I agree.
T-O. Yeah, something like that. But see the problem, right? Volkswagen spells it T-O-U-A-R-E-G.
Yes.
And I've heard Volkswagen internals pronounce it differently from person to person. So, like, what do you do? As a person, what do you do there?
I'm not saying people. I'm saying as professionals in broadcast journalism, we need to understand how the brand...
I am a quote-unquote professional in broadcast journalism.
Yes.
I had two different Volkswagen people describe it to me two different ways. How do I pronounce it?
The vernacular, the way that it is pronounced in the commercials, if you watch the VW commercials and if you listen to people who are, you know, somehow associated with the brand. I'm not talking about people who don't. There are a lot of people in the brand who don't, but it is Touareg. It's not Tuareg. The British say Tuareg. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. And then don't pronounce like Hyundai. When Hyundai came to America, people asked the CEO how he pronounced it, and he said Hyundai like Sunday.
Well, they did an ad campaign actually to tell people how to pronounce it to go with Hyundai.
Yeah, and yet you still hear Hyundai.
It's it's regional, right? Like in Korea, if I'm correct.
I'm sure. Yeah,
it's Hyundai.
Right.
Right.
So I'm Czech, right?
Right.
I don't say Praha, which is the way you say it in Czech. And when I'm speaking English, I say, you know, Prague, even though as a Czech who was born there, I could say Praha, which is the right way of saying it.
But at some point, like, just it's all, you can't get grumpy about this.
I'm grumpy about it.
But it's all wishy-washy. Okay, so how do you say Porsche?
It's Porsche.
Okay, why is it Porsche?
Because in German, you pronounce all the letters.
So how do you say BMW?
BMW.
But how do you say it in the U.S.?
I say BMW.
Yeah. Well, why don't you say BMW? If Porsche is Porsche because it's German.
Because I pronounce it in the vernacular, the way that it's meant to be pronounced.
Well,
in
then
this
you
country.
Should always say it BMW.
How about names that you know are pretty like Cayenne? People mispronounce, and that's a type of pepper. That is not an African tribe. It's a Cayenne is a type of pepper. You should know how to say Cayenne.
So you say Porsche because that's how they say it in German, right?
I say Porsche because that's the way you should say it.
Okay. So why don't you say BMW? That's how you're supposed to say it.
No, because it comes across as snooty and
well, that's
and
what
weird.
Some people say about saying Porsche. No, it's Porsche. It's
like when I was a TV reporter, we had an anchor who was Spanish speaking.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Sandinistas were like a big thing. And he'd always be like, today, the Sandinistas, you know. And I get it. That's how you say it in the Spanish language. But there's a way that Americans say it. And so you say it in the vernacular. And as a broadcast journalist, you should know what the vernacular is for that name.
But the vernacular is different from person to person.
It's not. There is a right way of saying it.
So
here, I'll give you an equivalent, okay? A lot of I hear this a lot from print or digital journalists, right? Mm-hmm. Where they don't know how to pronounce a name. And having done both, it would be the equivalent, in my ears at least, of a print person misspelling the brand.
I get it.
You understand?
Argument's flawed with Porsche, Dad.
Okay.
Because Porsche is how you say it in German, but then you say Mercedes like an American. See the problem? So you say Porsche like a German, but Mercedes.
I'm not saying you say it like a German. Once again, you say it the way you say it in the vernacular of that country.
But the vernacular for Mercedes
is... And there is a
is,
proper vernacular. The proper vernacular for Porsche in America is Porsche, not Porsche.
But the proper vernacular in that country, like you
said,
is Mercedes.
It's not. It's for the country that you're living in.
I don't know.
Like I say, I'm going to say Prague and not Praha, even though if I said Prague in Czech, in the Czech Republic, people would laugh
so
at me.
So the vernacular for the Czech car company in the U.S. is Skoda.
So
you have to say Skoda.
Yeah, and not Škoda.
Yeah.
Because if I say Škoda, people are going to be like, what the hell?
But then I'm saying that falls apart real quick.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, because it falls apart with Porsche. Because the vernacular is Porsche. That's how it would be.
No, because
that's
we're broadcast professionals. Sure, maybe a 10-year-old on the playground is going to say Porsche. But the vernacular for proper broadcast professionals is Porsche.
But my argument, Dad, is...
I get your argument,
the vernacular is that because that's how it's pronounced in its home country, right? That's how Porsche is pronounced in Germany. So why does that one get the exception, but we don't walk around saying Volkswagen?
It just does. It just does. I get it. We say Volkswagen. How does Andre say it?
Volkswagen.
He says, so in German, a V can be...
Could be like kind of the W is a V, Volkswagen.
So it's not Wolf.
It's not Volkswagen.
It's not Wolfsburg. It's Wolfsburg.
Right. It's not Volkswagen. It would be Volkswagen. Right.
Right.
Or yeah. So I
like to say VW.
Yeah. I'm just saying it gets wishy-washy, right?
I'm just saying there's a right way to say it, and a lot of people who are in the know don't say it the right way. And yes, these are hard things. I don't know why the brands pick these weird names like Touareg or Cayenne or Macan. Yeah, is it Macan or McCann?
If you're going to...
Is it Macan? I don't know. I don't know. Macan
if you're going
Macan.
To call your car the Tiguan, then you have to expect people to pronounce it wrong.
I think Tiguan is actually Tiguan in German too, because it's half tiger
but
and iguana.
But it's such a stupid name. I mean... Right?
So that one is the combination of tiger and iguana and you get Tiguan.
Porsche cannot figure out how to name a car in a normal way.
Like, call it the number, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's catchy.
The internal.
The 981.2. That's a really catchy name there. Uh-huh.
Well, you do that with Mercedes.
Yeah, because we're nerds. But nobody's going to go around and be like, the facelift W126, right?
The E36.
Or the post-LCI E92. Like, what a great name for a car, right?
You know, it's also confusing. The 5 Series BMW is the F80. And now Ferrari has created a car called the F80. The internal. The internal
but
for the 5 Series
see,
F80.
That's why it doesn't work.
Ferrari now has a car called the F80.
At least to Tesla's credit, Model S is an easy name to remember. Right?
Well, that's also so freaking childish. Because it's Model S because he's trying to spell out sexy cars.
Sure, but at least when it's I was memorable.
12, when I was 12, I thought that was really clever. Now I just think it's juvenile and asinine.
It's better than Taycan.
Taycan.
Taycan?
No, Taycan.
Anyway, we'd love to hear your input on this matter.
Taycan. T-A-Y-C-A-N, Taycan.
Okay, let us know what you think in the comments. No, it's not. It's Taycan.
Taycan, yeah.
There you go! Even you just got it wrong!
Taycan.
Terrible, guys. Let us know
what you think. It's like Thai.
This rant has not worked at all. You have not proven anything.
All right, Mr. Porsche.
It's a fail rant. All right,
Mr. Porsche. And you always do that, too. You do, like, when the French word comes out, you say it the French way, and I cringe.
Yeah, because...
Citroën. Peugeot.
Because Citron, it sounds wrong. I think there's got to be a balance. I'm not going to call it Citron if the manufacturer Citroën. Is Citroën.
Oh, I love that. It's like all you're missing is that French cigarette and your Citroën and a croissant.
I just think it's all over the place.
I'm driving my Citroën to get a croissant.
I don't criticize these
in a baguette.
I don't criticize the people that say it weirdly because they're all weird. That's the fact of the matter. Guys, let us know what you think.
And by the way, Skoda is Skoda.
Yes, and we'll see you next time.
Ciao.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.